Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Deep Water, a program on religion, culture, and public affairs. The theme of the program is that we as faith communities are only in our social ministries up to our ankles, and we ought to be over our heads, hence the name Deep Water. Our panelists today are the Reverend Sharon Moe, Senior Minister of University Temple United Methodist Church here in the University District of Seattle, Rabbi Jim Morrell of Temple B'nai Torah in Bellevue, Jeff Siddiqui, a member of the Greater Puget Sound Muslim Community. My name is Don McKenzie, and I'm Minister and Head of Staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. We had hoped on this program to speak in some depth about the decision by King County Prosecutor Norm Mailing not to prosecute Mel Miller in the shooting of Robert Thomas Sr. Unfortunately, Robert Jeffrey, one of our number here, was not able to be here today, and we have depended on him for much of this discussion because he is the minister of a community that feels the vibrations from this incident far more deeply than the rest of us. But we have decided to nonetheless to go ahead with a discussion about racism in general, hoping that when Robert is able to be with us again that we can get more deeply into this particular issue. But one of the questions that has been raised in the wake of this decision is the question of racism. Are we racists in this culture? And I would say, for me, the answer is yes. That's the way we respond to these kinds of things. That is, those of us who are white, especially those of us who are white people of privilege. We have this ingrained response that is driven by fear and by the racist need to build up our own self-esteem at the expense of the self-esteem of other people. That would be my definition of racism, and I'll ask my colleagues here to talk about their own in a moment. Let me ask a couple of questions. Let me begin by asking the question, what is it in our culture? What is that thing that's living among us that drives us so quickly to the use of deadly force? Not just in our streets, but in our international relations, in the penal system. What is it? What's going on here? What are we trying to kill? What are we trying to get rid of? What are we trying to purge, to exercise, to put behind us? Whatever the right word is, there's something that we desperately need to eliminate as a culture because we don't even think before we act. And I would argue that that happens at all levels of the culture, from our most intimate family relationships to international foreign policy and so forth. So let me put that question on the table, and let's begin with Sharon Moe. What's on your mind, Sharon? How do you respond to that?
I respond to it first from the perspective that whenever anyone asks the question, does racism have anything to do with this, whatever the this is that is at hand, and someone answers no, then most certainly it has to do with racism. Because to say that our violent, fear-filled responses are not connected with racism is to deny those deep feelings, those ingrained beliefs that we all hold of fear of what's different. And it is by acknowledging that racism is a part of this particular incident and of the way we live our lives together that we begin to be able to look at those fears and those prejudices and our impulses, our immediate reactions that are violent that come out of those fears and prejudices. So first, I think certainly basically the incident of the killing of Robert Thomas Sr. is a racial issue that we need to be able to look at and acknowledge before we can go toward any kind of healing in our society, in the black community, in our larger community. But second, I think that since 9/11, the ethos of fear has been promoted by people in power in the government, wanting us to be afraid and to hate what's different. And I think that comes out of the same basis of racism.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that what we're trying to kill, what we're trying to get rid of, is our fear?
I think that could well be. Or that which provokes mm-hmm. our fear, yeah. which is anything that is different yeah. or threatening to us. Anything we don't understand, anything that feels like it will threaten our well-being, our status quo, anything that we are not able to handle, so that nothing in us or that belongs to us is risked.
Right.
We will try to kill whatever raises that impulse of fear.
It feels to me as if that thing is something that is that something is profoundly unsteady at the center of our common life. And I think you've just described it in those terms as either fear or that which provokes fear. Rabbi Jim, the Jewish community is no stranger to this. What's on your mind today?
Well, I've done a lot of reading on this particular incident, and I guess on one level, you'd have to say there's a complexity there because unless you've been there for all the inquests and for all the hearings, it'd be hard to say that you have all the information. But just on the surface of it, when you think about it, if there was a car parked in front of your house mm-hmm. and you live in a middle-class white neighborhood and the two people in the car are white and they may be in front of a driveway but no one's getting in or out of the driveway, logic says you would do nothing. You would do absolutely nothing.
That's right.
Because if you had to get out of the driveway, you'd punk your horn and the people would move.
Mm-hmm.
You don't send someone from the off-duty police to tell the people to move. So right there, on the surface of it, you know that the whole incident was precipitated by the fact that there were two black men in the car. I mean, if anybody says that that wasn't the case, I mean, that is so clear. So the whole element of fear and prejudice and racism, no rational person can say from the outset that that wasn't the main factor. What precipitated after all these things occurred, who drew their gun first, why a person has a gun, an off-duty police person, that's a whole different issue. So we're talking about fear and talking about racism. And once you recognize that, then you're kind of at the heart of it. And I remember one thing that the Reverend Jesse Jackson once said, and I think it was a very telling statement that he made. He said, if I'm walking down the street at night and I hear footsteps behind me, and I turn around and I see it's a white person, I feel relieved, you know, because I myself, even as a black person, have this prejudice that a black person is more dangerous. So it's not just mm-hmm. white people who have the feeling. He recognized that it's something that's so endemic that even black people have the sense of fear. And that's a very, very deep thing. But the incident was precipitated by the fact that there were two black men. They were doing nothing wrong. They were doing absolutely nothing wrong, you know, on the surface of it. They were just sitting there, and it didn't need any response. And if it were the white people sitting in that car, there would have been no response. So the whole thing was precipitated by racism.
Jeff.
I think racism is an effort by those in power to retain their powerful position, to retain their property, to retain their influence, to retain the money. They want to make sure that this pie that I have because of my privileged position remains. And the way to keep it is then try to identify and isolate the other, whether the other is black or women or Jew or Muslim or whatever, or in some countries white. It is an attempt to isolate the other. And it would wither on the vine if there wasn't the leadership leading people headlong into racism. Mm-hmm. And part of me gets mad at the sheriff's deputy, and gets mad at in some cases, the FBI, that as a Muslim, I see they're coming after Muslims. And then I stopped and I thought about it, and I think, no, these guys are simply the tools. They're the dogs of war that have been let loose on an innocent population. The people to blame and hold responsible would be the people at the top. In this case, the sheriff himself, and in another case, John Ashcroft himself. And it's only when you hold the leaders answerable that you can hope to contain and stifle racism. Otherwise, what you're doing is analogous to maybe bursting the pustules on chicken pox and thinking you're attacking the disease. Yeah. You're not.
What do you think, Don?
Well, I think we have to confess, as people of privilege, that we have no idea how painful this situation is for people who are not privileged in this culture. We can go home at night and go to sleep and forget it. And there needs to be some step taken toward turning that around. I agree with Sharon that until we are willing to confess that, yes, racism is an important issue, that the pain of the African slaves 150 years ago may in fact not have changed that much in the 150 years since the end of the Civil War.
Indeed.
I think until we confess that the major decisions in our culture are still being made by white people, and mainly by white men, and that it shouldn't be that way, that is, the decision-making process should be a shared process within our culture, and that there should be some way to lessen the fear that people feel and in its place put an expectation that difference can be a source of vitality. Not just tolerance. I'm not saying, you know, just leave people alone. I'm saying be willing to be engaged by difference and let it be a source of vitality in the culture so that we can grow together. So this, for me, what this raises is the question, if there is this thing that we're calling fear at the center of the culture that's making things so unsteady that causes us to be trigger happy, traditionally, a trust of some kind in something would be the counterbalance to that. Our money says, "In God we trust." I think we'd like to. Many people in this culture do, I think. But what is it that we trust in this culture? Let me ask the question another way. Plato said, "What is honored in a culture will be cultivated." So the question is, what do we honor and do we trust that? What is it that could be the counterbalance to this unsteady thing in the middle that we're calling fear?
The cynical answer is we trust money. That's why we put God's name right there on it. The other answer potentially could be that we trust in democracy, and perhaps we don't exercise democracy sufficiently. We're willing to let our leaders exploit situations in favor of racism, and we're willing to let them do that and continue with it. And in many cases, our two major parties exploit that even more because they know that, well, the Republicans are going to continue to vote Republican because they are not likely to want the Democrats to take it, and the Democrats are going to continue to vote Democratic because they don't want Republicans to win, so we really don't have to pay attention to their opinions. And so as people, we get marginalized because we don't dare vote outside of party line. And the first salutary lesson of that was in the presidential election, which I think is a lesson that certainly the Democratic Party is trying to eradicate by saying, see, you cost us the presidency. My lesson from that event is, see, our opinion means something. And maybe if we exercise that some more, we can change it around. But democracy, perhaps, is a value we respect that has potential for us.
I think what I trust and what I think has the power to be redemptive for us is the gift of getting to know someone who's different, of forming relationships with people. And that's the reason that when I was invited to go to Iraq in May, I made that trip and then made it again in October and just returned from Iraq. Because I think our government, this administration, is playing so heavily on the fear factor after 9/11 and the fear of terrorism to turn us toward violence as a way of protecting ourselves, protecting what we have, protecting our interests and our privilege. And there's something deep inside me that rails against being manipulated that way. And as a faith community leader, I wanted to put my belief into action. And so made both of those trips in order to put myself in the midst of what I'm being told is frightening and to relate to people that I'm being told are hating and frightening to me and to this country. And when I went on those trips, what I discovered was that indeed relationship, stepping into difference, is a very powerful thing. And I believe it has the power to, in our racism here at home, in our relationships with our global neighbors, and in this whole question of whether we go to war against Iraq, have the power to move us from fear and from hatred to a relationship that's based on democracy, that's based on mutual understanding.
Pastor Sharon, one of the questions that I think a lot of Americans have about Iraq is that the distinction between the leader of Iraq, who's demonized Saddam Hussein, and the people of Iraq, who are diverse, like just like we in America are very diverse, but certainly a majority are Muslims. And the whole idea is that we're not going to war against the Iraqi people, but we're going to, if we do go to war, we're going to war against the regime. That's an evil regime, evildoer kind of thing. And so, obviously, that's a kind of beltway rhetoric, but what's your take on it in terms of the people that you had a chance to meet with, and if you have any sense of this kind of regime, this demonized regime represented by Saddam Hussein?
I think there are two things about that that are important to keep in mind, and hopefully I can remember both here. One is that the people themselves are and have been in a position of being held hostage by their President Saddam Hussein and by our administration, not just the Bush administration, but the administrations four decades back, but especially this last decade, the 90s. They've been held hostage by the sanctions, by the continued bombing that happens that has never ceased over these 12 years. We were in Basra, and an air raid alarm sounded, and the people went about their business without flinching because it is such a common thing for them. When I was there in October, there were five bombings in Basra, in the Basra area, while we were there. This is a continuous thing for the people. So it is the terror that is holding them hostage, and it is both leaders who are holding them hostage and the sanctions themselves and the 12 years of stark sanctions. But on the other side of that, it's really important to remember that if we do mount an all-out attack on Iraq again, it is the people that we are attacking. Mm-hmm. It's not Saddam Hussein that we're attacking. We'd like to move him out of power so that we could control the oil interests in the Middle East, I'm sure. But we can talk until we're blue in the face about getting rid of Saddam Hussein, but it is the people that we're going to be killing.
Mm-hmm. I concur with what you're saying very much.
And how many people, how many lives is enough? Haven't we already taken some number between 800,000 and 1 million because of our sanctions?
Yes.
So
most of them children.
What is the value in Iraqi lives of the head of Iraq, Saddam Hussein? How many people are we willing to kill? Obviously, in my book, too many.
And mine too.
So we're, I think, suggesting a parallel between our international concerns about Iraq and what goes on in the streets of our city. That perhaps the urge toward war with Iraq reflects the same urge that is driven by fear here in Seattle. Fear and perhaps the urge to dominate, which is another tremendously complicating factor. But Sharon.
But yeah. I think they come together, fear and the urge to dominate, in the specific fear of loss of what we have and what fuels our privilege, whether it's power or material goods or influence or the sheer military ability to dominate the world. I think that's where fear meets our desire to be the dominant power.
Doesn't greed have a lot to do with it? Isn't fear sometimes a cloak for greed? Because greed is what causes us to create the fear and fuel the fear.
Mm-hmm. And even though there are, you know, I would not call most people greedy, I think there is a deep reluctance to lose what we have.
Isn't that greed, though?
Well, that's the question.
Just to return briefly to the question of what values can be a counterbalance to this thing we're calling fear, another possible counterbalance is the value of spirituality. I'm saying that because it feels to be the most inclusive way of talking about religious experience or theological values. And I'm saying that because here we are in America in the year 2002. We are no longer, the Protestant Church is certainly no longer at the center of the decision-making process and hasn't been since John Kennedy was elected president back in 1960, which to my mind is a good thing. The country, when the country was founded, there wasn't much of a distinction between the values of democracy and the values of the Protestant Church. But here we are now in a situation where we are confronted with the desperate need for the Christian experience to find a way of living cooperatively with other faiths in this world in a way that might contribute to the common good, we hope. All this, I think, suggests that we're in a real time of transformation or metamorphosis from a time when the Christian church dominated this culture to a time when, at best, it will be a participant, a player in the way things are worked out theologically. I think one of the consequences of this time of transformation is that the value of theological experience has trouble making itself known on a wide cultural plane. And so the challenge for those of us who are religious leaders, whether we're Christians or Jewish or Muslim or Buddhist or Hindu, is to find ways to cooperate and make that value of cooperation among faith traditions so visible that the fear of being different can be lessened, I think, just by that. I agree with Sharon that naming racism as a presenting issue in the fearful way we live our lives is the first step toward a movement towards some kind of healing. So one last question. We're almost out of time. And we may not be able to answer it today, but is there anything of substance in what we've been saying that can be valuable to those who have lost people either here in Seattle or in other parts of the world as a result of the latest round of fear and violence and so forth? Is there anything we've been saying that might be of some comfort even to people who are feeling desperately marginalized and at a loss for how to deal with their own losses?
I would suggest that the part in which everyone can take comfort is this is not forever, this is not permanent, this is not a lasting issue, racism, I mean. But the part that should make us uncomfortable and make us want to do something is the part that says it is up to us as individuals, whether we are the oppressor or the oppressed, or just bystanders, to get out there, speak out whenever we see injustice, and show it, demonstrate it on the ballot box. If it means voting outside of your desired party group, that's fine. It's time our leaders found out that we're not blindly partisan, that we do care, we do have a moral standard, and if they don't follow that basic standard, they're out.
We haven't really talked about the whole issue of the proliferation of weapons, which is certainly one part of the reality, because hatred and violence is endemic, but when you couple it with the availability of weapons, certainly the level of destruction is raised up exponentially. And so probably it strikes me is that we have a culture of violence, and in the short run maybe we need to put a little more effort into using this moment as a time to really reawaken the desire for serious gun control, because I think that in the incident with Mr. Mohammed and Malvo, certainly that kind of comes home. We don't know their motivation, we don't know what motivated their hatred, but it was availability of guns that enabled them to perpetrate the violence, and the same thing really in the Miller incident too. I don't think people who are not active police officers on duty should have guns, period.
I agree.
So that's part of it, and maybe just a small part of it, but I think that struck me as part of the problem that we're dealing with.
Well, that's our program for this time. We thank everyone who has tuned into us today. We ask you to join us again next month for another step down into deep water. This program was produced by Mike McCormick. Until next month, may God bless you and keep you.